addressed today. I addressed the statutory construction issues that I addressed in Town 3, propositions of Article 1, 2, 3, and 4, and then we're addressing the propositions of Article 4 and 5. Mr. Schmidt will address the constitutional issues, and we'll attempt to divide our time equally. First, I would request that we reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, and we will attempt to divide our additional policies.
You need to watch your time on the clock there closely.
Yes, thank you.
Doing all that, we better get directly to the law. If we hold to you, don't we have to read out of the statute 5733041?
Yes, we do. 5733041 defines income. But at issue here is that income is defined as taxable income, as required to report on the federal income tax return. So at issue here is what is taxable income. We maintain that this case involves the definition of taxable income. There's three reasons why we believe that the state's construction of these depreciation add-back statutes is improper. Number one, from a federal constitutional standpoint, taxable income does not include a recovery of capital. To the extent that you sell an asset to recover the capital under Eisner's duty to recover, that is not taxable income. What the depreciation add-back statute is trying to do is exactly that. In a case where we have a net worth taxpayer and the depreciation add-back statute applies, the taxpayer is forbidden from ever conducting amortizing that depreciation add-back.
You said federal constitutional. Well, I thought he was going to discuss the constitutional matters, and it seems to me that saying constitutional raises it to the level of the Constitution, protecting that as not being income or making it income. How's that found in the Constitution? Is it more statutory than rulemaking?
Well, I can remember, so that it's in a constitutional sense, gross income, economic gain. Income is economic gain. And what they have said is that to the extent that a transaction is not resulting in economic gain, it is not taking the constitutional sense. Secondly, longstanding principles of federal tax policy dictate that when that gross income does not include funds received attributable to the recovery of an item which did not generate a tax benefit in prior years, the old tax benefit. This is a common law principle in the federal tax statute, it is longstanding. It's also codified in the federal statute, section 111. That section expressly says that it's not to encompass all of it, it's just to provide a few applications. This court, although we're talking about Eisner v. McCumber and Wisconsin's tax liens in the federal statute or in the federal context, we're talking about longstanding tax principles, this court has recognized that in interpreting Ohio statutes, that many times the Ohio statutes must be read in context with the federal scheme. And that's what we're trying to do here.
But you keep talking about income, and didn't the taxpayer in Ohio, in this case, file its returns, the franchise returns on your net worth as opposed to income?
Indeed, Your Honor, filed them under the net income method. In other words, the refund years filed under the net income method. The depreciation add back, the adjustments that we're talking about, took place in the net worth years. You're correct.
Right.
The net worth years,
and the statute says income, not net worth, doesn't it?
The statute says income, that's correct. What I am arguing, Your Honor, is the fact that when those assets were sold, the funds that were received by the taxpayer, in this case, in the 3 years, it was $524,000, $599,000, $640,000. Those funds received represented the return of his capital investment. And under any tax policy, to tax the return of your capital investments provided a big disincentive to business taxpayers, discouraging investment in the state, discouraging investment in assets. I don't think any other state in the United States taxes the return of capital.
Is it really that they're taxing the return of capital, or is it actually that the calculation of net worth involves that return of capital to calculate the net worth?
Well, the calculation of net worth, when you have a return of capital, the calculation of net worth should not change because the basis of the assets, that all you're really recovering is your basis in the assets. From a net worth perspective, your calculation doesn't change. From a net income perspective, and I think this goes back to your point, John,
You said from a net worth standpoint, your calculation doesn't change.
The calculation of the taxpayer's net worth.
Okay. He sold assets.
That's correct.
And he sold depreciated assets.
That's correct. So to the extent that you...
What kind of an accounting theory do you show cash out a depreciated asset to get cash?
That's correct.
Reflect that on your balance sheet is still carrying the cash?
On the asset side, we're going to have an asset. In this case, we kept originally calculated the original tax on net worth basis. There's going to be a depreciation add back that is never going to be amortizable under the Ohio statute. That is going to be reflected in the asset side. So if the debt basis is $10, for instance, and I receive $20, you're correct. And I receive $10 from the sale of that asset, I now have cash at $10, and I no longer have an asset, book value of an asset for $10. My net worth has not changed. If I receive more than that adjusted basis, then I do, then my net worth has in fact changed.
Let me ask, it seems to me that what you're arguing is a policy issue, is it not? I mean, I don't see the constitutional issue here. That the statute, General Assembly provided two ways to report. One is by net income and one is by net worth. Your client chose to report by the net income method, and now you're trying to get the benefit that the General Assembly has provided for those who file under the net worth method.
It's more deeper than that. It is fundamentally what constitutes taxable income. I understand the franchise tax, the privilege of the ability to do business within the state, but how do you measure that ability to do business in the state? The purpose here is to tax the fair value. And when we're looking at taxable income, as it's defined in the Ohio Revised Code, they're going back to federal income tax principles. And what I'm saying, what I'm arguing here today, is that when we receive a return of that unamortized depreciation add back, that is not taxable income as defined in the Internal Revenue Code and under any type of tax policy.
So you're really trying to equate the terms federal taxable income with net worth for purposes of your argument. We all know that those are different, at least we've all been trained that they're different.
Well, Your Honor, I guess federal taxable income I define as the gross income less the deductions that are allowed under the Internal Revenue Code. Gross income under Section 63 of the Internal Revenue Code is gross income less your basis in those assets.
Why would the General Assembly not then have said in subsection C, federal taxable income or net worth? That would have been very hard.
What section, Your
Honor? That's the section we're talking about, 5733.41.
In subsection C?
At 25% of the amount for which the corporation's federal taxable income before operating loss deduction. All the way through that section, it talks about federal taxable income.
Your Honor, if you go back to 573301, and I guess my contention is that in that statute itself, in the depreciation add back statute in 0.041, there was no need to address this because federal taxable income, by definition, excludes basically a recovery of capital.
So you really want us to read in fair material. You want us to read 01 in effect into 041.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Good morning. My name is Michael Schmidt. I'd like to briefly address the constitutional issues that we face here. Under the cases Nordingland versus Hahn and Allied Stores, any discriminatory treatment of taxpayers must rationally further a legitimate state interest. And as the U.S. Supreme Court has stated, the adverbs and the adjectives in that sentence are more important than the nouns and the verbs. There is no rational basis and there is no legitimate state purpose for this kind of discrimination. The state has alleged that it wants to slow down depreciation deductions, and that is the purpose here. Slowing down is fine, but permanently denying tax basis is unconstitutional because it's discriminating against net worth taxpayers. These are taxpayers who are just starting out, they're investing new capital in Ohio, and return on that capital. When they first start out, they incur losses. When they incur those losses, they report on the net worth basis. Now at the time when they need these net operating losses, the state is stripping these away from these net worth taxpayers. So we cannot...
Well, counsel, didn't all taxpayers used to have to pay on a net worth basis, all corporate taxpayers?
That may be, and if the state were to either require all taxpayers to report on the net worth basis, or if the state were to completely strip away the net operating loss,
well,
that would be fine.
Wasn't the addition of the income approach an offer of an opportunity to pick whichever was most advantageous to your corporation is the way to...
Just the opposite, whichever generates the most revenues for the state. I'd like to reserve some time for rebuttal. I may conclude unless you wish to continue, Your Honor. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schmidt. Mr. Farron.
Even found in the Ohio franchise tax law, so there's nothing
certain statutory adjustments to that federal taxable income, which are contained in your revised code section 5733.04i, and the specific ones issued in this case, which were added after Congress enacted HRDA in 1981 to grant an accelerated depreciation, was to allow adjustment, both additions and deductions, in revised code section 5733.441. That is the statute that controls in this case. The inquiry by the court in this case should begin and end with a review of that statute, and determination must be based on whether the adjustments, deductions, whatever the taxpayers want to call it, are set forth in that statute. And a review of that statute will clearly reveal that the tax commissioner followed the clear, plain language of that statute and properly denied a deduction or this basic adjustments, which is really no more than an end run to attempt to avoid what the General Assembly provided with respect to the deductions. As it was gone into some during the argument of the corporation's counsel in this case, the franchise tax is based on the greater than computation under the net income or the net worth test. Net income is defined, on contrary to what the accountants have argued in this case, is specifically defined in the Meyer Revised Code Section 5733.04i defines net income as the taxpayer's taxable income before operating loss deduction and special deduction that's required to be reported for the taxpayer's taxable year under the Internal Revenue Code. That is line 28 on the federal return, which is carried over to line 1 of the corporate franchise tax return. That is federal taxable income. From that figure, the statute, or the General Assembly has provided by statute, for certain adjustments, both additions and deletions. None of the adjustments or deletions sought in this case by either Zalas or Jack Schmidt is found in either 5733.04i or 5733.041. The specific adjustment relevant in this case is found in 5733.041, and it basically is an adjustment in reaction to Congress's enactment of accelerated depreciation, because the accelerated depreciation would have had a drastic effect on the Ohio franchise tax revenue for a number of years. So the General Assembly said, well, let's spread that out. So the first provisions in that adjustment section required an add-back of the accelerated depreciation. Took your federal tax rate and added back 25%. Some of the other provisions are different percentages, but the general add-back was 25% in the year in which you received the accelerated depreciation.
Now, is that exclusively for the income approach to computing the tax?
You add it back regardless of the approach, but in the ensuing 5 years, if that add-back was made in a franchise tax year in which the corporation paid on a net income base, a one-fifth deduction could be made in each of those ensuing 5 years, basically making 100% of the initial add-back. But the statute is very clear. The deductions are only available if the add-back depreciation was made in that initial year in which the corporation filed on that base. In this case, it's absolutely clear, it's admitted by both of the corporations in this case, that in none of the years of the add-back depreciation did they file on the net income base. In fact, they all filed either on the net worth base, and in the case of Jack Schmidt, they admitted that they paid the minimum tax. They didn't pay on the net worth base. So clearly, under the language of 5733.041, neither of the corporations were entitled to the deduction because they did not meet that initial requirement that the add-back they sought to deduct was made in a year in which there was work on the net income. Any argument that the net income is some, the beginning point of net income is some figure other than what is reported by the corporation for federal tax purposes simply ignores the plain language of the definition. The General Assembly decided to use a simple manner of calculating a net income base. They didn't want arguments over what deductions are included. They didn't want to incorporate and make a corporation or the state recompute be allowed in the federal income tax code. They took a simple approach. They just used the ultimate figure that was determined to report federal income tax purposes and then made statutory adjustments. Clearly, that is what the General Assembly intended. Clearly, that's what the statute provides. With respect to the equal protection argument, that fails for a basic reason. There's no classification here. In the first instance, there is no such thing as a net worth taxpayer or a net income taxpayer. Every corporation, every year, has to compute its liability on the basis of both the net income and the net worth base. It then pays on the greater base. A corporation that pays this year on the net income base may, because of its business operations next year, end up paying on the net worth base, or may pay the minimum tax if it has a negative net income and a negative net worth. Corporations are not net worth corporations or net income corporations. They're simply corporations, and all corporations are subject to all of the same rules in 5730.3041 and every other provision in Chapter 5733. Certainly, there's been no evidence presented by either of the appellants here to demonstrate that the General Assembly, by eliminating the ad hoc to years in which a corporation paid on an income base, created some probably arbitrary classification tax. It makes sense.
Well, Counsel, I think I got to see what thinking through this a little more and trying to recall the form that these taxpayers throw out. If your corporation, for purposes of the state of Ohio, you determine your net worth, you have a balance sheet at the beginning of the year. Then you reflect the income and expenses to determine an income answer for franchise tax purposes, right? You reflect what you show the income of the corporation to be.
You would do so, but that's not necessarily the same income that may be found in federal income tax return, if that's your question. Net worth is just, you can have your books on a net worth basis.
Well, but don't you have to, isn't there a place on that form where you have to reconcile all of this, what went on in the incomes side, and so when you get to the end of the year and you do your balance sheet for purposes of the franchise tax, that has to be reconciled with what went on in terms of income. You can't show an income amount and then just magically get to the end of the year and have a new net worth figure, right?
You can, Your Honor, for purposes of distinguishing the income that you show for federal tax purposes or Ohio tax purposes. And basically on the federal return, there's an adjustment provision shown there. But you don't adjust the books of the corporation. You're not required to adjust the books of the corporation. For instance, a corporation can maintain its books on some regular depreciation basis, and yet for federal tax purposes, you use accelerated depreciation.
Right.
You don't change your books. You're not required to change your books to show the accelerated depreciation. In fact, in this case, review of the balance sheet attached to return shows that they did not reflect accelerated depreciation on the books of the corporations in these cases. This case is very similar to a case earlier decided by this court, Atlas Franchise, in which a corporation similarly attempted to take a deduction because of some depreciation in federal and state laws. This court noted in Atlas Franchise that the General Assembly dealt in detail with the specific adjustments that were to be allowed to reduce or increase federal taxable income. It found no specific provision authorizing the deduction requested or claimed by the taxpayer, even though it clearly did have some effect on the basis of the property at issue in that case. The court expressly held that unless the statute provides a specific deduction or exemption, that it is not to be allowed. That's a matter for the General Assembly to decide. And they pointed out, if the General Assembly had intended to grant an adjustment for that particular item, they would have done so. In this case, the same is true. This is not something that is hidden anywhere. was thoroughly discussed. This is subject to General Assembly. If they thought it was a better way to proceed, they could have put a specific provision in the adjustment sections for basis adjustments or for some adjustment based on a disallowance or a tax recovery act. They didn't do so. And I believe the reason they didn't do so is because that would have added a large degree of complexity to the system. There are so many variables that would have to be considered in trying to make various types of adjustments requested. In this case, given all kinds of scenarios, it would be extremely difficult to administer and to
How specific does it have to be, for example, on deductible expenses for these taxpayers? The General Assembly doesn't have a laundry list that says nuts and bolts and exactly which items are deductible and which aren't. They're in fairly large categories, and there are traditional accounting accepted practices under the federal and state tax law system.
Your Honor, most of the deductions that are going to be obtained in determination of the net income base are already included within the bottom line federal taxable income figure. So it's not federal gross income, it's federal tax income, which is after all most business deductions and other deductions. From that figure, however, the General Assembly, in very detailed terms, 12 categories of adjustments covering many pages of the higher advice code. Our point is, it's not in any of those. As Atlas Frankchef said, if it's not in any of those, it cannot be allowed. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Barron. Mr. Honda, you've saved almost 4 minutes of your time. Mr. Schmidt.
Let me first respond to the Atlas Frankchef case that was addressed by counsel. That is a 17-year-old case that involved a first-year taxpayer construing it. Kind of an obscure depreciation statute under Section 9J. In that case, the taxpayer sought an additional $1.5 million for depreciation deductions above and beyond what its tax cost basis. Here, we're only trying to apply the federal taxable income principles in computing the Ohio taxable income component of our taxable income. We submit that this court can move from a formalistic approach to statutory interpretation to a functional approach, as the U.S. Supreme Court did 75 years ago in Eisner and the Ludi cases. And under Foster v. Evett and under Davis v. Willoughby, we ask that this court follow these cases in its own decisions and do not construe or imply a tax where none was intended, and that this court not frustrate the legislative will by imposing a tax on our clients by stripping away tax basis that creates net operating losses and then deny those net operating losses when our clients subsequently dispose of these assets 3 or 4 years down the line. We ask that any doubt in construing these statutes, as this court stated again in Davis and Foster, be construed in favor of the taxpayer. I want to go back to a point that Mr. Honda made, and that is that these taxpayers start out with net operating losses. They frequently have a lot of net worth when they capitalize a new business, and therefore they report either at the minimum $50 or $150 minimum tax and pay on the net worth basis. But they have a very large net operating loss. Now, the state could have stripped that away, but they didn't. And so this net operating loss is the thread that ties these corporations' losses in their startup years to subsequent years. And the CapEx, though, is a clear reflection of income. So it's only a question of proper tax accounting here. It can be resolved by either granting us the depreciation deductions or, as other state courts have in Texas and Pennsylvania and Tennessee, and two of those three are Supreme Court decisions, granted an adjustment to basis, and they said they hold this is just proper tax accounting. They want to give businesses the tax basis. And we don't see any intent for the legislature to strip away basis and strip away net operating losses. And we don't think it was inferred Rather, we think that the functional approach to construing this statute is to say that the state meant to defer, merely defer these deductions, and not to permanently deny tax basis and depreciation to any of the businesses that are, there are new businesses starting in Ohio, or maybe it's a major expansion, maybe it's a major factory or business that's invested a lot of capital and therefore they pay on a net worth basis. We don't think that there was an intent to strip away 25%. We acknowledge that this is a franchise tax case, but yet the state can only fairly tax our taxpayer clients in a manner that some that is reasonably related to the volume and value of business and services that they receive. So we ask the court to look at the various years, look at the net operating losses, and see how they tie together. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schmidt. The case is submitted. You will be advised of our opinion.